Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, dedicated to supporting the state's health with doctoral and master's degrees in nursing, counseling, nutrition, and more. Viterbo.edu/graduate.
Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 1st. And Dr. Bill Duddleston will chalk the pulse of our economy this hour. Professor Duddleston joins us from time to time with an analysis of economic issues in the news. And we had a caller request during my open line program yesterday asking for Bill Duddleston, so we're happy to oblige, and we are happy he was able to oblige because there are plenty of economic issues making headlines these days. Bill Duddleston is always able to give us some context and understanding of the numbers, and we will talk with him about whether or not the economy is in good shape or not. What's this housing slump all about? Are we, should we be concerned about a recession? How strong or weak is the economy, and how might that influence public policy decisions? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. If you have questions or concerns or any dollar and cents issues on your mind today. Bill Duddleston is a professor of economics at Edgewood College in Madison and director of the Economics Education Center in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a new addition to your title.
No, it's just something I've finally put up there as a way of distinguishing myself.
Oh, okay.
I've been director of the Education Center for almost 15 years.
Oh, well, all right. You just educated me on that.
Well, we have a big program in the summer now, so I now have another hat to wear. So I'm pretty busy during the summers doing that.
You know, I was watching some business show on cable news early this morning. I just had the TV on as I was getting ready for work, and these various investing experts and economic pundits were on that show giving all sorts of different forecasts of the economy. Some were saying the economy is still strong and steady. Others were saying there's no doubt this it's weakening and we ought to be concerned. So what is it? Is it strong? Is it weak? What is it?
Well, the most recent figures on economic growth, real economic growth, stripping away the inflation that pumps up numbers, was a bit disappointing first quarter. It was came in at 1.3%. That's the first estimate. There are two more estimates that will come out before the end of June. So we'll see what the true estimate is then. But it's a bit worrying that the economy may be running out of steam, especially that it's only firing on the consumer. The consumer is carrying the economy. Business investment was disappointing. Even government spending was faltering, and defense spending was down, surprisingly. And the foreign sector is weak. We have a huge current account deficit. And at least for the February figures that came out a few weeks ago, exports were down. And that should not be happening. The rest of the world is growing, and the dollar is relatively weak. And so that should stimulate our exports, and those exports were down. And people are still trying to figure out why that's the case. So I guess people are concerned about the competitiveness of the United States with respect to other countries, and that foreign sector is definitely a negative. So I would agree with people that are concerned about the fact that we could be developing into a slow growth mode for quite a while, and that could easily tip into a recession if the housing situation were to deteriorate further.
The question that was posed in an Associated Press article that was in the paper just the other day, was former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan right when he put the chance of a recession this year at 1 in 3? What's the answer?
This year, I would say it's probably 1 in 10, just making bets. There's still a fair amount of momentum. You can look around and lots of buildings still going up, and workers are still working on non-residential construction. I'm more concerned about 2008. So if you were to ask me what the odds are of 2008, I would say that is closer to one-third in 2008. Greenspan has been pretty quiet lately because he was sort of chastised for upstaging Ben Bernanke and causing ripples in the in the economy and also the stock market back in February. And so he's become much more guarded about his predictions lately. And I think he should. Paul Volcker, who was Greenspan's predecessor, stayed off the stage and didn't make a lot of comments about how the economy was doing, because in a sense, it's forcing Bernanke to be very, very defensive. And in his light, it's not shining on him, it's shining on Greenspan, and that causes some ego problems, I guess.
But. Now, the Fed Reserve, as I read here, is going to be meeting next week.
Right, and, the Federal Open Market Committee will decide upon whether they will keep short-term, what we call Fed funds rate, the same at 5.25%. Will they lower that rate to 5%, or will they raise it to 5.5%? And there are different economists who believe that you should do one of those, and they vote accordingly. It's about one-third, maybe one-fourth say there should be an increase because they're concerned about the value of the dollar falling, and they are concerned about the inflation numbers that are coming out. In the first quarter, inflation was running at an annual rate of 4%, but that was mostly due to energy prices increasing and food prices increasing. So if you look at what they call the core inflation rate, it was around a little over 2%. And so most economists aren't worried about that at this juncture. The whole issue of food, though, will become more problematic as we move into the summer, and whether we have decent weather and whether there's great demands for food is going to be the big question mark. And so food may be entering a stage where it will be contributing to inflation for a longer period of time, not just from month to month or episodically.
Just before we went on the air, you said that what we might be in right now is something that's called stagflation light.
There's an article in Barron's News Magazine, and they sort of very journalistically spice things up. And so they refer to the fears of slow growth, which is stagnation, and higher rates of inflation, not to the degree that we had in the 1970s, where we had a very, very high rate of inflation and very high unemployment. So that was stagflation, and it was a real problem for policymakers. Now it's the fear is that we'll have it on a lighter version of that stagflation, which is inflation may kick up to 4%, and that growth will sort of drop down to about 1%. And then you'll begin to see some unemployment increase, but nothing to the degree that we saw, not compared to what we saw in the 1970s. Because in the 1970s, we had to deal with the fact that about 3 million new workers were entering the labor force each year. Combination of baby boomers coming of age and of working age, and also women entering the labor force. So the job market in the 1970s was much more complex, and we were characterized by higher rates of inflation. Unemployment right now, unemployment is 4.4%, and that's relatively low given our history and compared to some of the other industrial countries in the world.
I have a girlfriend who decided to flip a house this spring. Yeah. She bought it was the old family home and going to fix it up and sell it. But she probably picked the wrong time to do this, didn't she?
Yep.
And what is
40%? 40% of the homes sold last year, I saw a reference, were either second home, vacation homes, or flipping homes. Namely, people were not going to live in them. They were just buying them, fix them up, and sell them. And so there's a fair number of those houses empty around the country. It may not be in this area, but in East Coast, West Coast in particular. And so those homes are sitting on the market. No one's living in them, or they're trying to rent them, and they can't. And so therefore, they've got some severe cash flow problems where they have to pay a fairly high mortgage, and that investment is not panning out.
Yeah, and this whole housing slump is affecting the economy how?
Well, it's taking away some of the steam, so to speak. There are studies, preliminary studies, that from 2003 to 2005, at least, about 40% of the increase in jobs that were being created was directly or indirectly related to the housing or non-residential construction area. Lots of condos being built, lots of second homes being built. And that engine of growth has been tempered dramatically, and so people expect that sector of the economy to actually shrink over the next couple of years. And that's where the worry is that 2007, 2008, you could begin to see some significant layoffs. As many of these non-residential jobs are finished, there may not be as many new jobs to pick up, and the housing sector will be sort of frozen for a while. Namely, there's not a lot of movement and therefore people are deciding to stay in their existing home, and they're not willing to take a chance to buy a new home because there's not as much liquidity available, cash available for the new home buyer who may not have the top credit score. That's what is called the subprime market and the Alt-A market. These are people who have credit scores that are below the desired number, and therefore they can't get access to credit as easily as they did back in 2004, 2005, 2006.
And what's with the stock market news that we've been seeing over the past several days? I don't pay a lot of attention to this, even though maybe I should. What does this mean, that stocks closed lower yesterday with the Dow Jones Industrial Average's string of gains ending at 4 and the streak of record high closes at 3?
That's the Dow Jones Industrial Index, which reached 13,000, kind of a milestone. Mm-hmm. Every 1,000 points seems to take on additional importance. And so it pointed to the fact that the stock market was doing better, even though the economy wasn't doing very, very well. And so there have been various analyses of it. I can give you three quick reasons why. One, private equity funds. These are firms like Kravis, Kohlberg, and Roberts, and Blackstone Group buying up companies that are public corporations and taking them private. Namely, they literally buy up the shares. And that's reducing the supply of common stock, and that's giving a boost to the Dow Jones because the value of stocks in general go up when the supply is reduced. The second reason is due to the fact that multinational corporations actually benefit when the dollar gets weaker. The dollar has been on a slump lately, and so anybody that earns profits in Europe in euros. The euro is now at about $1.36. Their profits that they make in euros get translated into higher profits here in the United States into dollar terms. And so their earnings per share are growing at a faster rate than originally expected. And the other factor that's playing out is mergers and acquisitions. And so that's putting a lot of money in play, and then also driving up the value of the 30 in stocks that go into the industrial average. The S&P has not reached its peak yet. It's still a few points away from it. So if it were to go over 1,534, there would be more newspaper articles talking about the fact that a wider index was reaching new highs. We'll see on that account, because even late February, the stock market took a real beating after the China market sold off, and there was a fairly significant decline in one day, a 400-point decline. So, you know, the stock market is very, very temperamental, so to speak. What I look at is the underlying values, and I also keep an eye on the transport index, which most people don't do. But the transport index actually went down last week, and it's also indicative of the fact that companies that move goods are not doing as well because that sector of the economy is moribund and we're losing more jobs in that area. And so, again, it's kind of a schizophrenic market.
We're going to take a short pause and then welcome in callers for Bill Duddleston, professor of economics at Edgewood College. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Also director of the Economics Education Center in Madison. We're talking with him about economic issues in the news and wondering how the economy is treating you and what questions you have or what concerns do you have. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Tuesday, May the 1st, May Day. And after 9, Kathleen will talk with guests about the statewide Civil Rights March, called A Day Without Latinos. Lots of May Day marches going on today. And Kathleen will talk about the one going on in Milwaukee at 9 o'clock. We're talking about the current state of the economy and economic issues in the news with Bill Duddleston, a professor of economics at Edgewood College and director of the Economics Education Center at Edgewood College. And we are welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And let's take our first caller, Laverne in Monroe. Hi, Laverne. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joy.
Morning.
Good morning, Professor Duddleston.
Good morning, Laverne.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here, to hear your voice.
I believe our country's going to go broke. Republicans call themselves conservatives, and they're bigger spenders than Democrats. I heard on the news that there are three hedge fund dealers making over $1 billion a year. They deliberately don't want an accounting system because they're using these derivatives so successfully. Now, on the other hand, we have our government elected officials. They're pushing borrow from Social Security, China, and Japan. Now, I think the country's going to go broke because of this, but do we blame the hedge fund dealers or the politicians?
Well, that's a tough choice. Let's go to the budget deficit first. In the long run, there is concern that Social Security, which is running a surplus now, will eventually start breaking even sometime in the next decade. And then when they go below breaking even, they have to start selling off their assets. And the assets they've been accumulating over the last 24 years is indeed government debt issued by the U.S. Treasury. And so one part of our government, the Social Security Administration, is running a surplus. The other part of our government is running a deficit. And so the Social Security Administration has been helping out by buying up that government debt because they have to. That's the only choice they have. And so that's concealed some of the true deficits that have occurred over the last 24 years. I think the surplus they ran last year was close to $150 billion. But don't quote me on that. It's off the top of my head. But it's a fairly significant number. The other issue you raise, of course, is that China and Japan have been regularly buying our government debt, mainly because they've been buying up our dollars to support the value of the dollar, which is an underhanded way, so to speak, of keeping their currencies lower than what the market would want. And so they're preserving their undervalued currency status so as to stimulate their exports. China, for reasons internally, that they're trying to make a transition from state-owned enterprises to private enterprise, and they want the private enterprises to export. So China buys the dollars, then turns around, uses those dollars to buy our government debt, and they're building up a fairly significant treasury, a hold of treasury bills, treasury notes, and treasury bonds that will come due someday, and the question is, will they continue to buy those in the future? So all those are long-term issues that are going to come back to haunt us 7, 8, 10 years from now. With respect to hedge fund executives, they take lots of risks. They're paid to take lots of risks, and when they're successful, they get paid that whatever that money you quoted. They get paid fairly high amounts of money. There is some controversy that they move some of that money offshore and they don't pay much in income taxes to the American government, and so some people raise questions about that. But the problem of any unregulated market is that if you do regulate them, then they go somewhere else and they do the same thing and they're outside the purview of your federal government, so you almost have to do it on a global scale. So that's the difficulty of any regulation. But there is some concern about hedge funds growing so dramatically. There's something like 8,000 hedge funds. And a few years ago, there were just a handful. And so it's become a very popular vehicle for the very, very affluent to invest money. And they're making very, very handsome returns. But they haven't seen some bad markets. And the last time they saw a bad market, a significant bad market, was 1998, when the long-term capital management hedge fund actually should have gone bankrupt. But then it was bailed out by various banks. But then those banks were sort of given a push by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where they held the meeting. So it's a very complex issue, and I think you bring it up because you're so concerned about it, and you have to keep it on the front page. But most people want to put it on the back page because they don't want to think about the potential risks of hedge funds. Last fall, Amaranth went under. $6 or $7 billion hedge fund, and most of the investors lost everything they had in that. So people should recognize that when you invest in a high risk venture, you may make a high return, but you also may lose everything you have, and you should go in with your eyes open. If you expect the government to bail you out, then that's called moral hazard, and that basically breeds more risk-taking, which then creates more systemic risk for the whole world economy, and that's what we have to watch out against. So, Laverne, keep asking those tough questions.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Laverne, for the call. George in Milwaukee is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I'm in the transportation industry. I sell heavy-duty trucks for a company here in Milwaukee, and I always keep a close eye on that market, of course. And I was wondering what your thoughts were. I heard you mention the transportation industry before, and I know a lot of my customers have high rates of driver turnout. But the other thing is how the new EPA 07 emission changes are affecting the industry. I know that we had a very good year last year because lots and lots of companies were pre-buying trucks because there's probably going to be over a 5% increase in total cost, 5 to 15% actually, or total cost of some of these vehicles for these companies with the new EPA regulations on emissions.
Well, and that's what usually happens when regulations come in, is that it spurs a growth of spending. I'm not following the industry in the detail that you do, and so I wouldn't pretend to give you any advice on that. What I do is I watch the transport index, which captures some of that part of the economy, and all I'm looking at is that it was a divergence between what the Dow Jones Industrial Average was doing, and there are not many industrials anymore in there, but that part of the economy which everybody looks at, but they don't look at the transport sector, which I do, because if it starts heading down earlier than other sectors, it's usually a leading indicator that the people that know what they're doing are beginning to sell some of those stocks because they expect the business to drop off in the future. Let me just give you one specific case. In September of 1989, the transport index dropped in advance of the Dow Jones Industrial Index. And that was a divergence, and it sort of was saying there might be a slowdown in the economy. And sure enough, in July of 1990, right before Iraq invaded Kuwait, the economy officially went into a recession, started its move into recession. Recessions are technically defined as 6 months of negative real economic growth, so that it started going down in July and continued all the way through March of 1991. So I'm just watching that to see whether or not the goods that are being shipped via train and truck start to diminish. And that means the economy is slowing down. The consumer right now is still increasing their spending. Last quarter, 3.8% increase, but that compares to 4% the previous quarter and up around 5 or 6% in previous quarters. And we think that the consumer may be tapped out as far as going into debt, and so therefore they may start to actually save money again in the positive territory. And that will have an impact on the American economy over the next few years. And so we may not have a recession, but we may have a slowdown. All the questions you have about the pollution impact, there's no question it'll have some impact on the cost of shipping goods and whether truckers can make some money.
What can you tell us about gas prices going up about a buck in the past month or whatever they've gone up, and what kind of impact that's going to have on the economy?
Well, in the wintertime, you had a drop in the international oil price down to close to $50 a barrel. Right now, the current market is up around $65 a barrel. Usually when we enter into the May season, heading towards Memorial Day, you'll see price increases because they have to stock up in anticipation of the prime driving period of time when people go on vacation and take trips and go to their vacation homes. So this is not atypical that you probably will see prices move above $3 by June. And this seems to be the kind of the equilibrium price, that the low point is 50, the high is 65, 70. A lot of that is related to uncertainty with respect to supply in the Mid East, Nigeria, a few other places. The demand, actually, the United States demand of oil is about scaled off around 21 million barrels of oil a day, and that's been pretty constant for the last 18 months. Some of the European countries have actually cut back on their consumption of oil. It's the new emerging countries of Asia, in particular India and China, but also some of the African countries, Latin American countries are all growing. And right now, the emerging countries consume more oil than the kind of old staid industrial countries of Europe and the United States. And so that's a market that is going to drive oil prices, because there's lots of people that live there and they haven't had cars, and now they do, and they'll continue to drive as long as they have the income to do so.
Yeah. Well, actually, since we have a caller on gas prices, let me go to Bob in Madison right now. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Yeah, you mentioned gas, and we have the lowest price gas in the world and the highest medical bills. I wonder if we could switch that around like the rest of the world, or more of a necessity.
Well, I guess you didn't really have a gas price question yet.
Well, we do have relatively low gas prices when you compare them to Europe and Israel and other places. But some countries that produce oil actually subsidize the gasoline for their residents. And so you have the ironic situation that Iran, which produces plenty of oil, has to import refined oil because they subsidize gasoline consumption. I think Venezuela does the same thing. Indonesia does the same thing. So I don't know if it's true that we have the cheapest. Maybe it's cheapest in relationship to our income, our disposable income. And we should recognize that gas prices reached a peak back in 1981, and that price is somewhere a little over $3 a gallon. So over the last 25 years, we still don't have relatively high gasoline prices, but it still hurts our pocketbook when we go to the gas tank.
Yeah, thanks very much, Bob. I was handed this article that was in the Wall Street Journal this morning that Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's leader, is aiming to weaken the U.S. by, I guess, giving more oil to China or Iran or other countries.
Well, he's renegotiating contracts. Union Oil, I believe it's Union Oil, is partially owned by the Venezuelan government. And so they have gasoline stations in the United States.
Citgo.
Yeah, Citgo, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Citgo. Mm-hmm. And so Citgo gets its oil from Venezuela. And so what they're trying to do is, I think, redirect some of that oil flow to China, where they can make a long-term contract with the Chinese government. The Chinese government's been doing this all throughout Africa. They've been going to the Sudan, they've been going to Angola and various other countries to work out long-term contracts that lock in a price that's favorable to the countries. And this is it's diverting oil away from the United States, and so therefore we have to go onto the open market and get additional oil supplies in the market. So that's obviously causing some ripple effect on the price of gasoline.
I was looking through the financial news wires early this morning when I came in, and I have to admit the story that caught my interest more than any of the others was the one regarding World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz. President Bush defended Paul Wolfowitz yesterday, said that he should be able to keep his job amid charges that Wolfowitz helped arrange a contract and a big salary increase for his girlfriend. Lots of people are calling for his resignation. The bank's 24-member board is expected to make a decision in this case this week. Any comment on this story and what in the world the role of, maybe you can just talk a little bit about the role of the World Bank, and does it matter if...
Well, the World Bank was originally set up as a kind of a reconstruction bank after World War II for the countries of Europe, but in particular countries that were defeated, and they wanted to rebuild those countries. So the World Bank was part of the Bretton Woods international monetary system that was set up mainly at the leadership of the United States. We hosted the meeting in 1944. The institutions went into effect, and the other institution that went along with that was the International Monetary Fund. So both of those institutions have been around for quite a while, and they've always been politically charged institutions. And the United States has always been criticized for having too much influence in those institutions. And so for the most part, the criticism is leveled at the IMF, because they've been kind of the enforcer of exchange rate rules and austerity programs. And the World Bank has escaped scrutiny until this most recent episode. And it has to do with a style, a personal style that Wolfowitz brings to the table, and also his somewhat ideological passion towards what's the right way for the World Bank to run its business, and that's running into the prevailing culture that has been there for the last 50 years, so 60 years. So I think what you have is a major ideological battle going on, and the bedroom affairs or whatever just make it a bit murkier, obviously. I don't want to get too much into it because it gets into a lot of political issues that also should not be there, but they are because of the fact that ideology seems to be trumping everything these days.
Well, still, though, do you think the World Bank's going to be looking for a successor to Paul Wolfowitz?
Well, no, this brings up the issue: how do they select the leader of the World Bank? And the United States has been the dominant force in putting forth their own leadership choices, and everyone else has agreed. Now, this may be symbolic in the sense that just as Toyota passed GM. As the number one world oil automobile producer, this may be the European countries beginning to flex their muscles vis-a-vis the United States and say, "Hey, no, we don't want the chair to be appointed by your president. We want to have some kind of neutral individual coming from a European country or an African country. And why does it always have to be an American at the head of that bank?" So.
We are talking with Bill Duddleston, professor of economics at Edgewood College, director of the Economics Education Center at Edgewood, about economic issues in the news. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned for Kathleen Dunn talking with her guests about the statewide Civil Rights March, A Day Without Latinos, coming up after 9 o'clock. Back to the phones for questions for Professor Bill Duddleston, and Eugene in Viola has been waiting. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy.
Good morning.
I had two comments, and Trainer didn't get a chance to take the second one. He had another call coming in. But anyway, the margin between what people are making and what it's costing them has been getting narrower and narrower over the years. Then you factor into that the price of gasoline. And this is a rural area here. You've got people living here who are driving across Tulsa, Sparta, and Reedsburg to work. Right. And they're putting $8 and $10 a day into their gas tanks just to get there and get back. So that's starting to hurt.
That's
a
right.
little bit.
Yeah. The whole structure of where people live and where production takes place has been dictated by relatively inexpensive gasoline. And so as soon as you move to a higher price, then the direct cost, when gasoline prices are around $3 a gallon, it's about 15 cents per mile traveled is coming out of your pocket. And if you take in the full cost of depreciation and other kinds of wear and tear on your tires, some people estimate it to be 50 cents a gallon, 50 cents a mile as your direct and indirect cost, because you're using up that car that much faster, or you have to repair it more often. So yeah, anyone who lives away from the major metropolitan area, and oftentimes they're doing that because they can't afford the housing in the major metropolitan area, then they have to eat that extra cost of transportation costs. It's also their time cost. So yeah, it's putting a real burden on those people who are at the margin, that they just have enough to make it from week to week. And if gas prices go up further, they will have to go into their credit cards and put up more debt.
Yeah. And Eugene, you had another question?
No, that was the only one.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Erica in Baldwin is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
That's great. The reason I'm calling is I have a few questions about, how the layoff situation is going to be affecting the foreclosures on properties. Now, I'm a mom of five. We've been, I've been married for 8 years, not a very long time. I'm a young mom of 26. I'm an at-home mom. But we just now purchased our first home. My husband works at a garage door manufacturer here in Baldwin. And they actually just laid off a group of people because they said that they're going broke. There's not enough money to get into, you know, the high cost of manufacturing this garage doors. But what that basis for us now as new homeowners is, where do we fall if my husband gets laid off and we only gross $23,000 for the year as is? So it's not like we make a lot of money. And, you know, there's so many foreclosures right now. What are the layoffs going to be doing for these building companies when the housing market goes down the way it has been?
Well, that's the concern that people have, is that this ripples through the economy, mm-hmm. that you begin to have a few people laid off, and then those few people stop spending, and then that ripples to the garage door openers. And so you have these all the industries that are connected to the building trades, and then that's where you have a downturn in the economy. And so the jobs, hopefully, that would come back, especially if the dollar were to go down, is export jobs to the rest of the world. But that's not a positive prospect at this moment, because some of our major competitors are not allowing the dollar to depreciate in value. They're holding up the value of the dollar by intervention. So anyone who works in an area where there's only one manufacturer and that manufacturer is hurt, then they've got to hustle for a job somewhere else in the service sector, and that may not be a very high wage.
That's where we're finding the biggest problem at, yeah. is that, he's been looking for another job just in case he is part of this layoff plan. But there again, he can't find anything that's going to pay him more than $15 an hour. You know, he's looking at $7 or $8 an hour, where that's not going to make our mortgage payment, much less any other bills that we may have.
No. Unfortunately, I have no positive solution to that, except that you got to create more jobs to employ people who lose their jobs in the housing sector.
Yeah, good luck to you, yeah. Erica. This one article that was in the Capital Times over the weekend, the housing slump is the main culprit, it says here, to this slow growth at that 1.3% growth. Is the housing slump is the main reason for that?
At this moment, but then it's also having a spread effect, which is that if it slows down consumption, because people aren't tapping into their home equity, because the home equity interest rate has gone up dramatically. And a lot of people forget that 3 years ago, you could have taken out a home equity loan at 4% at prime. The prime rate was 4% because the federal funds rate was 1%, and now it's 8.25%. So it's more than doubled. The carrying cost of those loans have more than doubled, and that's what's beginning to hit people, because a lot of people took out home equity loans and are now paying a monthly charge that's over twice what they were 3 or 4 years ago, and that begins to build up. And so one solution to this, of course, is for the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates to take some of that pain away and to revive that ability to borrow against home equity. That's their ace in the hole, but the question is, do they want to do that with the inflationary situation that's developing and the fact that the dollar would fall, most likely, as people are predicting, and then that would cause all imported prices to go up, and that's where oil prices would also go up even higher. And so you're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that's why the Federal Reserve is trying to keep things steady, hoping that other sectors of the economy will kick in. And what should be happening is the export sector should be going up. But there's another historic, just as Toyota passing GM, there's another historic development occurring. I don't know which month it'll happen, but if you keep an eye on the employment report in May, June, or July, we may have a historic crossing point, which is that the number of jobs in the goods-producing area will drop below the number of jobs of government, namely the government, all levels of government, federal, state, local, will employ more workers than in the manufacturing sector, in the goods producing sector. They're both sitting around 22.5 million, and manufacturing has been going down and government's been going up a little bit, especially because of school hirings out west. So again, these are trends that are important, because they act as kind of a signpost for the future, that we should be exporting more, but we're not. And you have to ask, with the dollar being lower, we should be able to export more in the world economy, but it's not happening. So it's a real enigma.
Let's take Bill in Sheboygan next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing? Good morning, Professor, and good morning, George.
Good morning.
In fact, my question is well-timed in light of your previous conversation. I just want to know, Professor, whether you agree with the supposition that the fact that the Chinese will not allow their currency to float is having a major effect on American manufacturing. And until they allow their currency to float, we will not see a resurgence in American manufacturing here in this country. And then if you do agree with that supposition, the second question related to that is, what do you think it's going to take to finally allow, finally get them to make the decision to allow their currency to float upwards, which clearly it's very significantly undervalued right now?
Yeah, I agree with the undervalued. It's undervalued. There's no question about that. They, for the first time in July of 2005, they allowed the Chinese yuan to go up by roughly 2%. And then just recently, the last 6 or 9 months, they allowed it to go up another 5%. So it's not fixed anymore, but it's still undervalued. And so the question is it 20% undervalued? Is it 30% undervalued? And so that does have a negative impact on our ability to export manufactured goods, because we're competing against a country that is not allowing its currency to appreciate. And so that's definitely impacting on our ability to export goods to the rest of the world, because we're in competition with China on some things. If you read today's New York Times, they'll also show you that we're importing food from China, and that scandal over pet food is going to be a big issue, and it may force some careful scrutiny, and we may even, and there's a debate going on at the World Trade Organization vis-a-vis China. So we're starting to put pressure on China to make them change. But the point is that they're a creditor nation, we're a debtor nation, and that's a hard thing to accept. But we don't have many levers to pull to put pressure on China. If they want to intervene and keep their currency undervalued, then we have to come up with some way of affecting that position. And I don't have any simple solution except to put pressure on them, and to put the pressure on the World Trade Organization to say that they're not engaging in fair trade when they indeed keep their currency undervalued. We're running a $250 billion deficit in goods. I don't have the trade for the numbers for services, but I follow very closely that we're running a $250 billion trade deficit with China in goods. And that's 10 years ago, it was maybe $25 billion. So it's increased dramatically in a very short period of time.
I'm not sure I understand what it means to allow your currency to float.
Well, floating is letting the marketplace determine the price of your currency. And so right now, lots of money is going into China. So that's capital flowing into China. And when money flows into China, that means they have to demand the Chinese yuan to hire the workers to build those factories. And so that should be putting pressure upward on the Chinese yuan. And when more people buy Chinese goods, they have to use Chinese yuan to do that. So they're buying Chinese yuan and selling dollars. So the dollar should be going down in value by the marketplace. But China is intervening, buying up those surplus dollars and creating Chinese yuan to do that. Now, in the long run, that's an inflationary pressure that will develop unless they take counteracting interventions in the domestic market. And so people are expecting China to start having significant inflation, but that probably won't occur for a few more years. And it's not a free market system in the strict sense of the word. There's a lot of controlled aspects of that economy because it's still run by the Communist Party. So it's not an easy subject to discuss dispassionately, and it does raise lots of fears. But the fact is that lots of companies, GM included, GM made a lot of money in China this year. They're losing money here, and so some people are, so that there's more and more manufacturers are moving to China because they can take advantage of the lower wage rates and the more lax regulations and virtually no health care costs associated with hiring workers there. And every time they hire a worker here, at least based on the UAW contract that's been negotiated, they have to pay a significant amount of money each month just for the health care plan of that worker. So there's lots of legacy costs that are here that they don't have to incur there, and that's creating a flow of production to China, which is making a big impact on the world economy.
Briefly, we did a program on the Toyota surpassing GM in worldwide auto or vehicle sales, but what does that mean, that milestone mean for the economy?
Well, it means that the UAW, when they start negotiating their next contract, is going to be on the defensive, because GM will probably say, do you want to be around in 5 years, or do you want to be out of a job? So let's start negotiating a change in the healthcare plan. Let's negotiate a change in the pension plan. Let's negotiate flexibility rules where we can move workers around more easily. And so all of the contract negotiations that have taken place over the years could be renegotiated to the favor of GM and to the disfavor of the traditional auto worker. So it will have an impact. And obviously, if you look at the statistics for the state of Michigan and Ohio and Indiana, all those three states are suffering. And so their economies are heavily influenced by the auto industry. There's a lot of parts manufacturers and secondary services into those. And those states are have higher unemployment than Wisconsin and Illinois, and so they're affected by the auto industry in decline. Both Ford and GM are having difficulties.
Almost out of time, and a couple of callers still waiting. Michael and Thorpe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I was just wondering about when the U.S. was taken off the gold standard, that there was such inflation and the dollar losing so much value that it was, in a sense, like an inflation tax or a confiscation of our savings, that would in the future the U.S. dollar fall so rapidly that we'd have to go back onto the gold standard or have a new currency or something? Could that ever happen?
Good question. If you take a long, long view, I think what you're referring to is 1971, when we went off the gold dollar exchange standard known as the Bretton Woods system. We went off the gold standard way back in the 1930s, and there was no inflation after that. There was actually continuing deflation, a little bit of inflation as we approached World War II. But the real inflation occurred after 1971. And the dollar fell from 1971 to 1980 by about 50% vis-a-vis all other currencies. And so that did contribute to the inflationary spiral of the 1970s. If we go through another decline, of a significant decline in the value of the dollar, it makes our goods more competitive, but it also it builds in inflationary pressures in the economy. And so you're right, inflation can be a tax on people who have their savings in a passbook saving or even a CD, because if you get a 4% CD and your inflation rate is 6%, then your real rate of interest is minus 2%. And forget it, if you have your money in passbook savings, you almost have to pay them to keep your money now. So, you know, these are issues, these are political issues, that money is wrapped up in politics. And how you put together your monetary system is a very, very important one. And that will play itself out over the next few years.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time for now. We'll have to have you back for an update. When do you think? What's the next important marker or milestone that we might want to be keeping an eye on?
Well, I would continue to keep a look at the trade deficits. If those trade deficits keep getting worse, they shouldn't be. But if they are, that's something to worry about.
We will keep an eye on that. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Bill Duddleston, professor of economics at Edgewood College, director of the Economics Education Center at Edgewood College. Thanks to Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing this hour. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.